From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, sitting in for Terry Gross. Duke Ellington would have been 100 years old today, and we want to celebrate his timeless music. We'll listen to some seminal Ellington music under the guidance of jazz critic Gary Giddens, winner of this year's National Book Critics Circle Award for his collection Visions of Jazz. Also, film critic John Powers reviews Existenz, the new movie from director David Cronenberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, critic at large for Entertainment Weekly, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest, Gary Giddens, has written extensively about Duke Ellington as well as the whole history of jazz for the past quarter century in The Village Voice. His book, Visions of Jazz, the First Century, recently won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Criticism. I don't know much about jazz, but I read Giddens all the time for the clarity and passion of his prose, and we thought he'd be just the man to help us celebrate Duke Ellington's 100th birthday. I was reading Ralph J. Gleason's book Celebrating the Duke, in which he described a TV interview he was supposed to do with Ellington, and before they started taping, Gleason said, "Now the usual format is..." And Ellington cut him off and said, "The trick is to do it without a format. I'll play a tune and we'll go from there." In that same spirit, I asked Gary Giddens to pick a tune and go from there.
I think we'll begin with Black Beauty, which is a piece from 1928. It's probably the loveliest melody ever written on the precepts of what used to be known as Harlem piano or stride piano. You don't usually hear ballads. You tend to think of Harlem piano as a kind of thumping, heavily rhythmic, dance, rent party kind of music. And it was written for Florence Mills, who was a great young star who died in her early 20s and was widely mourned in black communities throughout the United States. And it interests me not least because, I think we should talk about this, but Ellington, like Gershwin, could write two kinds of beautiful melodies, one for songs that required or deserved and usually got lyrics, and another kind of melody that is entirely instrumental that you hear mostly in his longer works, sometimes in introductions and transitions. And I think Black Beauty is a perfect example of that, a beautiful melody, but not a song per se.
Great. Let's hear some of that. That was Duke Ellington and Black Beauty, written, I think, in 1928.
28.
I read a remark of the late music critic Robert Palmer, who said that Ellington's career stands as a rebuke to the common evolutionary history of jazz, that Ellington observed no, quote, as he said, orderly historic transition from swing to bop. Do you agree with that?
No. I think, to be fair, I think that he means that Ellington is always Ellington, and that's certainly true. But Ellington also, and this is, you know, essential to this understanding his genius, reflects the period, and his music evolved enormously. I mean, his whole concept of swing changed radically after the Second World War, and he certainly employed bop harmonies. Most of them he prefigures, but his arrangement of Perdido, for example, is a kind of bebop classic. And by the mid 1960s, in the Far East Suite, which I think is perhaps the greatest of his later works, he clearly has absorbed Coltrane and modality and using scales instead of chords. Almost everything that you can find in jazz of any consequence, you can usually find in Ellington first in some way. But then it comes back as it's explored by other musicians, and Ellington always seems to be on top of whatever's happening in any period. For example, I mean, the best example of all, I suppose, would be that Ellington had a swing band long before there was a swing era. But after the swing era came in, he began writing pieces that showed that he was very much aware of what other arrangers and musicians were doing. The Tattooed Bride, the great climax of that, an extended work from the late 40s, is almost a homage to the Benny Goodman style of clarinet playing.
You write in your book, Visions of Jazz, that Ellington had an ambivalence toward the term jazz. What was that ambivalence?
Ellington seems to have known from the very beginning that if they went along with that word, and I have to say that I've acutely felt this as a critic, that he would never be regarded as a musician. He would be regarded as a jazz musician, which is sort of like being asked to sit at the back of the bus. When I started my column at the Village Voice, they wanted to call my page Jazz, and I refused because there was already a page called Music, and I was not going to accept a title that suggested that what I was writing about was something other than music, so we settled on a neutral term they permitted me to choose, and that was Weatherbird. Ellington understood this immediately, and he and Fletcher Henderson used to talk about it. You know, we've got to avoid this term. What we're doing is composing and performing music. It's a new kind of music, perhaps. And musicians have felt that way all the way down the line. Miles Davis hated being called a jazz musician in the late 1960s. He finally came to learn to live with it, as Ellington did. But for many, many years, the term was used to dismiss their music as a kind of ephemeral fashion of the day, a popular music that had no real serious import.
I'm talking to Gary Giddens, author of Visions of Jazz, The First Century. Let's hear a little bit more of Ellington music. There was a cut I think you wanted to play from the early 40s called Conga Brava.
Conga Brava, yeah.
Could you set that up for us, please?
That's one of the lesser-known masterworks from that extraordinary period of the early 1940s where Ellington simply never falters. It's an intensely rhythmic piece, and it's one of the pieces that I always think of in terms of, we were talking earlier about Ellington foreshadowing. Well, here is hip-hop America in 1940. It's a series basically of very stolid rhythmic vamps, and then suddenly the band comes in and you begin to hear the voicings and the melodies of Ellington, but always based on a cross current of different rhythmic rhythms and beats.
Great, let's hear some of that. Mm-hmm. That's Duke Ellington's Conga Brava. In the swing era, was Ellington writing for the technology of the times, for the 78, for the LP? Were the compositions written for those lengths?
Yes, Ellington, this is one of the interesting things about him that people often forget, in that he was very conscious of the technology from the very beginning. If you listen to Ellington records from 1927-28, and you listen to records by Fletcher Henderson or Chick Webb from the same period, Ellington's music's records sound a lot more vivid, a lot more alive, not just musically, but technically, because Ellington understood that the recording devices of that period were particularly good at taking lower notes. That's the reason why radio producers always looked for baritone singers instead of tenors. Radio picked up the baritone voice better. So Ellington began to voice the baritone saxophone as the lead instrument in his reed section instead of the alto saxophone, which was standard. And he figured out a way to create a kind of figure and ground between the soloist and the ensemble. So there's a constant changing in the dynamics and the timbre of each piece. And these make them seem very clear. And the music is always terribly articulate. And he continued to work that way. In fact, in 1932, he was one of the first musicians to make a bona fide stereo recording with two different microphone placements. I should point out that many of his recordings in that period were done for Victor, and Victor had by far the most sophisticated recording operation in that period. And then in the middle 1940s, he was among the first to take advantage of tape and of the LP, and probably the first composer, certainly the first that I'm aware of, who actually wrote music to exploit the unique properties of the long-playing album. Most people thought of the LP as a dozen 78s or a symphony on one disc instead of six. But Ellington began to write pieces of music that were 15, 20 minutes long, and it really liberated him in a way. And I think he was the first also to use overdubbing in Liberian Suite, which was in 1947, a 10-inch album where he had written an introductory movement, a kind of heraldic song, and then five dance movements. And then at the last minute, he decided to impose a song over that opening movement called I Like the Sunrise, and he overdubbed Al Hibbler's vocal. And he continued to work that way. And then ultimately, I think he realized, after writing a number of long-form pieces, tone poems, he called them, that the ideal format for Ellington was the suite, because it's a large form that consists of small forms. And he was, above everything else, I suppose, a miniaturist. And the suite allowed him to combine miniatures to deal with longer subjects and longer themes. And, of course, this could only really be done on the LP.
My guest is Gary Giddens. We'll continue our celebration of Duke Ellington's 100th birthday in a moment. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We're talking to Gary Giddens on the 100th anniversary of Duke Ellington's birth. Certainly one of his most popular compositions was Take the A-Train.
Yes.
Would that qualify as, say, what we would consider one of his hit singles?
Yes, I should point out that Ellington didn't write Take the A-Train. Billy Strayhorn did, mm-hmm. Who had just come into the band during the ASCAP strike when they couldn't play ASCAP music on the air. So he required Billy Strayhorn and his son to write BMI music that they could. Take the A-Train is one of the most celebrated of all Ellington records and one of his most brilliant orchestrations. And it has a really remarkable trumpet solo by Ray Nance. I should point out, it's a two-chorus solo. And the first chorus he plays with a mute. And then there's about four or eight bar transition by the ensemble, which gives him plenty of time to take the mute out. And then the second chorus is played open horn. And for many years, people thought that it was too separate trumpet players. It's not. And Nance's solo became so famous, it actually became as famous as the melody itself in jazz, so that anyone who performed Take the A-Train ever after would always have someone play either the trumpet solo or they would orchestrate the trumpet solo for the ensemble. And Ellington used that trumpet solo every single night for the rest of his life. Even after Ray Nance left the band and Cootie Williams came into it, he had to play that solo.
Great. Let's hear some of Take the A-Train. That's the Billy Strayhorn composition, Take the A-Train. You mentioned Billy Strayhorn earlier. I think with the publication of David Hadou's recent biography of Strayhorn, there's been a big rise in the importance of Strayhorn's contribution to Ellington's work. What's your evaluation of Strayhorn?
Strayhorn is one of the most gifted arranger composers in jazz history. I include a chapter on him in the Visions of Jazz because I don't think it's fair to Strayhorn to always write about him as the shadow man in the Ellington world. However, I think it's important to say that Strayhorn was very well known to the public, even though he didn't perform. If you go back and look at the old Esquire polls, Strayhorn always came in number two as arranger and composer after Ellington. And when he died in 1967 in Downbeat, it wasn't the critics' poll that put him in the Hall of Fame, it was the readers' poll. So Strayhorn was well known because Ellington always began every set by saying, "Thank you for Billy Strayhorn's Take the A-Train," and his name is prominently displayed on all of the pieces that they wrote together, and his photograph appeared on the Tchaikovsky adaptation, the Nutcracker Suite they did together. So Strayhorn wasn't entirely in the shadows, but his life was so completely devoted to Ellington that he didn't do very much outside the band. Of course, ironically, his single most famous song, which became an enormous hit for Nat King Cole, was Lush Life, which Ellington never recorded. It was the first song Strayhorn ever wrote, probably the only important song that he wrote before he met Ellington. But from the time he joined the band in 1939, for the next 28 years until his death, he was Ellington's right-hand man in every way. He not only composed for the band and arranged, but he could be deputized to conduct. He was a fine pianist. You can always tell the difference when Ellington or Strayhorn are on the piano, even though you can't always tell the difference in their compositional style. And he wrote some of the most exquisite concertos, especially those to feature Johnny Hodges. His style is much more impressionistic than Ellington, and it's impossible to talk about the Ellington legacy without talking about Strayhorn, because he is so integral a part of it.
What do you think were Duke Ellington's limitations? Did he have any? Would you say that if he had a weakness that was, say, as a lyricist?
Well, he wrote some pretty good lyrics. "Jump for Joy," I think, is a delightful and very funny lyric. And I believe, yes, he did write the lyric to "I Don't Know What Kind of Blues I've Got," which is one of my favorite Ellington recordings, with Herb Jeffries singing this very original and witty blues chorus in the middle of the recording. But no, he was not a great writer, and he required the talents of other lyricists, including Strayhorn, John Latouche, Don George and Johnny Mercer wrote the lyric for Satin Doll, and many others. This was not his forte. When you talk about Ellington's limitations, it seems to me one of the great things about him is that he usually recognized them and then attempted to compensate. For example, the very first recordings he made give very little sense of what Ellington is to become, and what's really missing from those recordings, twofold. First, a really powerful sense of swing, and then even more important, a blues tonality, which is essential to jazz and to Ellington's music. And when he heard Armstrong a couple of years into his leadership, he understood that that's what was missing, Louis Armstrong, and then he began to use musicians in the Armstrong mode. Bubber Miley was the first, Cootie Williams, and others. And so the band immediately took on that aspect and became the most swinging of all orchestras and the most blues-conscious, and even in all of his pop songs, like In a Sentimental Mood, which is based on the pentatonic scale, or Mood Indigo, or Sophisticated Lady, they all have a blues tonality written into those melodies. So usually he was able to figure out where the lapse was, and he was able to find other musicians who were able to help him correct that lapse. But there certainly weren't many limitations.
Gary Giddens is the author of Visions of Jazz, the First Century, which recently won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Criticism. We'll continue in the second half of the show. I'm Ken Tucker, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture, and Bantam Books, publisher of Sabbath, Restoring the Sacred Rhythm of Rest by Wayne Muller, available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our celebration of Duke Ellington's 100th birthday. Jazz historian Gary Giddens will discuss Ellington's later works and his posthumous Pulitzer Prize. Plus, film critic John Powers ponders director David Cronenberg's latest foray into the bizarre, Existenz. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker. Today we're celebrating the 100th birthday of Duke Ellington with Gary Giddens, music critic for The Village Voice. His book, Visions of Jazz, The First Century, recently won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Criticism. You write in Visions of Jazz that Ellington recognized early on that, you say, a trumpet solo by Cootie Williams was a very different animal from a trumpet solo by Arthur Wetzel. And you say that he prized frazzled originality over faceless virtuosity. My question is, if so much of Ellington's music was composed by him with particular players in mind, does it mean that the primary way we should listen to him is in these original recordings as opposed to live band or orchestra performances, you know, subsequent to those original recordings?
Well, Ken, that's the $64,000 question. That's the question that jazz people have been debating now for some 30 years. Ellington's death had an enormous impact on the music because it raised that very question. You know, we thought he was going to live forever. He seemed to be. And as long as Ellington was alive leading his orchestra, other conductors and musicians were afraid to play the music the way he wrote it. And not just afraid, but they would have considered it insulting. They were stealing his thing. But then after he died, the question becomes, if it's really a classical music, that is to say a music that survives the period of its creation, it can't exist only on recordings any more than 19th century European music can exist only in scores. It has to be played. And I think, again, you can find the answer to the question in Ellington's own work, because he recorded so many different versions of his major works that it's impossible to say that any one is definitive. Which is the definitive tone parallel to Harlem? There are five versions, and they're quite different. And not to mention the shorter works which he recorded and revised. Earlier we were talking about Take the A-Train, and I mentioned Ray Nance's famous trumpet solo. Well, after Nance left the band and Cootie Williams joined the band, he interpreted the solo. He played the same notes, but in a completely different tone and sound and attack. So right there, he's telling you that you can play the music, but it doesn't have to be an exact photocopy of his recordings. There's plenty of room for interpretation.
Let's play an example of what you were talking about before, about some of his more ambitious compositions from the Far East suite, a cut called Blue Pepper.
When the Far East Suite was released, it was widely praised in the jazz world, but also criticized as all, it's important to say, virtually every major work that Ellington wrote was attacked in its day for not being the major work that he had written 10 years earlier. It's hilarious to follow the criticism of Ellington over the course of his 50-some-odd years as a band leader. And Far East Suite was, a lot of people just thought, another one of those suites, whereas the real masterpieces from the early 40s. Now a lot of people think Far East Suite is one of those quintessential 60s recordings, you know, almost like Blonde on Blonde or Sgt. Pepper or Coltrane Live at the Vanguard, because it's one of the first albums that really deals with the idea of a one-world music, an internationalist approach, and not least, because of the way it employs rock rhythms. And the piece I suggested we play, Blue Pepper, was criticized at the time as some sort of meretricious attempt to combine his music with what was fashionable. Whereas, in fact, I think when you listen to it today, you realize what an absolutely brilliant use of rock rhythms it is and how authentic it sounds in attempting to create a style of music that falls into the theme of this work, which is the various places that the band played in the Far East and in the Near East during his tour of 1966.
Good, let's hear some of Blue Pepper.
Thank you.
That's Blue Pepper from the Far East Suite. I'm talking to Gary Giddens, author of Visions of Jazz, The First Century. Since you brought up the subject of rock and roll, how did the 50s and 60s affect Ellington? Did rock and roll have any effect on his orchestra and his career?
He attempted to write R&B pieces as early as the late 40s. You have to remember that Louis Jordan was hugely popular. He was, for a while, probably the most popular black performer in the United States. And he was grabbing the thunder of a lot of jazz musicians. Their audiences were going to hear him. And Duke attempted to write some R&B pieces. Most of them are egregious, I think. One of them was called Juke Juke, and they just don't work because he's not, his heart isn't in it, and there's always a sort of a sense of parody, a kind of noblesse oblige, as though he didn't really believe this is where he should be concentrating his talents. He also wrote a rock and roll song for Ella Fitzgerald called Imagine My Frustration, which isn't terribly memorable, and another one called One More Time that the band used to perform with great success for its audiences, although there's a reason why he never recorded it.
Which is what? Why?
Which is that it's terrible. It has very little value as a piece of Ellington music. But I remember going to hear him play at, you know, dance places where the audience was entirely adolescent or, you know, under 25, let's say, in places like Miami Beach hotels and things. And when he'd pull One More Time out, the band, the audience would go nuts and they'd all jump up and start dancing. So he understood that. But the way in which I think he really heard rock and roll and was able to use it is in pieces like Blue Pepper, where he simply, you know, underscores the backbeat that was always there in his music, but in a way I think he feels a little liberated to even take it another step.
Also in the 60s, Ellington was denied the Pulitzer Prize. The committee voted it down. He received that Pulitzer Prize posthumously earlier this month. What did you think about when you heard that Ellington had been given a Pulitzer Prize?
Oh, just a very sick joke. There was no surprise. Everyone knew that the Pulitzer Committee was going to do it because they gave it to Gershwin last year, and they were between a rock and a hard place. You know, they gave it to Gershwin for no reason other than that it was his centenary, and so how could they not do it for Ellington? You know, big deal. They gave the guy award 25 years after his death. When the Pulitzer Prize for Music, I think they started giving it out in either 43 or 46. So they had, 30 years in which they could have chosen any number of his pieces. And if they had given the award this year with some kind of a statement acknowledging what they had done in 1965 and speaking, you know, admitting that this was a compensation, then I think it would have meant something. But this was just a kind of pro forma thing. And I think it's like, you know, the Oscars, suddenly they realized, gee, we ignored an awful lot of important people like Chaplin and Garbo and Edward G. Robinson and Buster Keaton. Why don't we start giving out special Oscars? And now they're giving out special Pulitzers. You know, 50 years from now, will they give one to Irving Berlin finally? And 100 years from now, Bob Dylan? I just can't take that thing seriously.
Well, what did happen in 65? Was it because Ellington was not at that point considered a serious enough artist?
On the contrary, the Pulitzer Prize jury voted unanimously to give Ellington the Pulitzer. And not only that, but they understood his music so well that they said, let's not give it for a specific work, but for the overall career, because in jazz, you create almost a state of mind with your music, and then you work within that, and you create all kinds of variations and pieces. It's not about one symphony standing out among all the others. And then the governing board at Columbia simply refused to deliver the award. They just negated the vote of their own jury. Two of the jurors quit in protest. And it created a tremendous amount of attention at the time, and Ellington's response was widely quoted. He said, "Fate is being kind to me. Fate doesn't want me to be too famous too young." He was 66 years old at the time.
Gary, why do you think the governing board at Columbia denied him the prize in 65?
I'd like to think that it's not racism. I think it's a kind of elitist snobbery of, you know, closing the gates against, you know, this music, which they didn't I think it frightened them. If we give it to Ellington, where does this stop? Do we have to acknowledge other jazz musicians too and pop musicians? And I think there was it's just this. You know, if you open up an almanac and look at all of the winners of the Pulitzer Prize for Music over the last 50 some odd years, most of that music, not only have you never heard, but you've never heard of. Now, America has completely dominated the world of music in the 20th century, as Germany did in the 19th century, and yet the Pulitzer has never reflected any of the major figures. And I think that maybe in 1965 it was just too soon and too frightening, and so they kept giving it to these very arcane, mostly academic works that nobody ever hears and that have had very little impact.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Gary Giddens. His book, Visions of Jazz, the First Century, recently won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Criticism. We'll continue after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gary Giddens. What were Ellington's final years as a creative artist like? He was creating these elaborate suites, writing the sacred concerts. Mm-hmm. Was he ever working beyond his powers at any point?
I don't think so. Stanley Dance, who is often referred to as the band's Boswell, a critic who traveled with the orchestra and did a lot of Ellington's writing, pointed out, and I think this was very astute, that when Billy Strayhorn died in 1967, Ellington seemed to compensate for the loss, which was just enormous for him, enormous personal and professional loss, by writing more than he had ever written before. And it is just astonishing how prolific he is in the last 7 years, from 1967 to 1974. On his deathbed, he completed The Three Black Kings. Didn't get to record any of these, obviously. An opera, Queenie Pie, which was also finished posthumously. And he had written all of those, three sacred concerts, which he did manage to record. A number of very important suites, the Latin American suite and the Afro-Eurasian Eclipse, I think are particularly wonderful from the 70s. And also stockpiled on his own steam hours and hours of music that he just knew would be released on recordings at some point. He would rent the studio, bring in the band, and they would perform these pieces. I should perhaps tell the story, if you like, of the Queen's Suite. It's one of my favorite Ellington tales because it so caught us, everyone, by surprise. In 1958, Ellington toured Great Britain, and the Queen really rolled out the red carpet for him and treated him wonderfully, and he was very moved. And so as a way of expressing his gratitude, he wrote a piece called The Queen's Suite. I think, 5 or 6 movements, about 20-25 minute piece. He went into the studio, recorded it, pressed one copy, and sent it to the Queen. No one else knew the piece even existed. This was recorded in 1959. Starting in the middle 70s, shortly before his death, he began referring to it. He talks about it at some length in his memoir, Music Is My Mistress. And on one occasion, he actually played an excerpt from it. I think it was when he was up at Tanglewood, although it was never released. So virtually nobody knew of the existence of this piece or what it was. And then 2 years after his death, in 1976, Pablo released an album called The Ellington Suites, 2 rather minor suites from that period, and The Queen's Suite from 1959, which was immediately acclaimed as one of his masterworks. And it is. It's one of his greatest achievements. And in the last 15 years or so, 2 pieces from it have already become Ellington standards, widely performed by jazz musicians. And now a third piece, Northern Lights, which David Murray has been performing, I think is going to become the third. So imagine feeling so confident of your work and being so prolific that you can take one of your most important pieces and just as a gesture deliver it to one person on earth and keep it a secret until after your death.
That is pretty amazing. I wanted to play a part of what I think is certainly one of his strongest latter day albums, the Salute to Billy Strayhorn, mm-hmm. and his mother called him Bill. I'd like to hear a little bit of the cut called Blood Count.
Blood Count, yeah. There's a story attached to that. Strayhorn was in the hospital, and he was dying. He had cancer, and it was the last piece he wrote, and he sent it down to the band, which was performing at Carnegie Hall, I believe, and it had no title at the time. It was just called Manuscript, and Ellington put it on the concert bill. He was always doing that, you know, pieces that other bands would rehearse for 2 weeks before they'd play. As soon as he finished it, it would be performed that evening. Sometimes Ellington would actually hold up the sheet music in front of the soloist because it was that new. And he performed it, and it was a powerful piece. And then after Strayhorn died, Ellington slightly revised the arrangement, and it became Blood Count, and the highlight of this terribly moving tribute to Strayhorn called And His Mother Called Him Bill. One of the most, I think, profoundly moving LPs that Ellington ever made. It's a concerto for Johnny Hodges, the alto saxophonist who was the most popular soloist in the band, and the soloist for whom Strayhorn most frequently wrote concertos. And I don't think Hodges ever played better in his life. And I might suggest also that people pay attention to the drums and the bass. Very, very subtle, but beautifully handled.
Good. Let's hear some of Blood Count. That's Blood Count from the album And His Mother Called Him Bill. Gary Giddens, it seems as if every few years there's some so-called swing revival with, you know, zoot-suited young players trying to huff and puff their way through Take the A-Train. You know, Brian Setzer Orchestra wins Grammys, the Cherry Poppin' Daddies. This, even Time Magazine said Harry Connick Jr. is, quote, the real thing.
That's Time Magazine.
Is this of any value, and how do you rescue someone like Duke Ellington from that crust of nostalgia?
Oh, I don't think he needs the rescue, because ultimately people will go back to the records and say, wow, this is different. I actually wrote a little bit about this in The Voice some months ago. I don't quite get it. It seems that most of these retro swing bands are actually taking Louis Jordan arrangements and jump band arrangements, and for the most part, and things like, you know, In the Mood, things that were not considered top of the line during the swing era, maybe because they're easier to play. And then the oddest thing about this retro movement is that the soloists are deliberately faceless. They all try to play in some kind of generic tenor saxophone style, which is exactly the opposite of what the great players were doing, where individuality was everything. It was the only way you could announce who you were. If you were the band was playing in a radio broadcast and you're a trumpet player and you've got 16 bars, you know, the audience out there knew after two bars, oh, that's Roy Eldridge. That's Cootie Williams. That's Ziggy Elman, Harry James, whoever it was. You could tell by their style. And there is no individuality in these performances. Basically, they use a very heavy bass mix and a backbeat, which has more to do with the jump band style than with jazz or the swing era. And I think it's just, I love the idea that it gets people dancing again. I think that's terrific. As someone who loves to dance myself, and I actually could never dance unless I was holding on to somebody. So rock and roll kind of alienated me from the dance floor. So I think that's all wonderful as a social music. But when you listen to these records, I just hope that people will move from them back to the originals and hear what it really sounds like.
Well, Gary Giddens, I want to thank you very much. My guest has been Gary Giddens, author of Visions of Jazz, the First Century. He's been talking to us about Duke Ellington on the anniversary of Ellington's birth 100 years ago. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Coming up, John Powers on Existenz, the new film from David Cronenberg. This is Fresh Air. Existenz is a new futuristic movie by David Cronenberg about virtual reality, starring Jennifer Jason Leigh. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
When David Cronenberg started out, he made horror movies with juicy titles like Shivers and Rabid and Videodrome. Pop classics that blended sloppy technique, gross-out goo, and amazingly rich ideas. But after his great success with the remake of The Fly, the Canadian filmmaker's work became increasingly literary, deliberate, and polished. His newfound interest in form produced his masterpiece, Dead Ringers, but it also led to the slightly dried-out coldness of M. Butterfly and Crash, which lacked his earlier work's emotional pull. But the juice is starting to come back in Existenz, an enjoyably slight sci-fi picture in which Cronenberg both spoofs and elaborates many of his trademark themes. The movie has a terrific beginning. The time is the not-too-distant future, and the place is a backwoods seminar in which officials of Antenna Research are about to test a brand new virtual reality game, Existenz, which you play by having your body plugged into the game's driver, a fleshy pod connected to a bioport implanted in the base of your spine. Existenz was designed by Allegra Geller, that's Jennifer Jason Leigh, the world's number one game programmer. But just as the game's about to begin, an assassin pulls out a weird-looking gun and opens fire, trying to kill Allegra, as part of a Salman Rushdie-like fatwa by a group of fanatics who think that games are evil. Allegra escapes along with a young security guard, Ted Peichel, played by Jude Law, and they flee into the countryside, where they meet up with sinister types, played by Willem Dafoe and Ian Holm. Soon, Allegra and Ted are moving between their real world and the game world of Existenz, a funny, menacing, topsy-turvy reality filled with people who speak in over-the-top accents. In the process, they come face-to-face with that favorite fortune cookie conundrum. What is reality? Here, Allegra and Ted get involved in a shootout that raises disturbing questions.
You've killed him. Are you going to kill me next?
Michael, he was only a game character. I didn't like the way he was messing with my mind.
You didn't like that, so you killed him.
He's only a game character.
Allegra. What if we're not in the game anymore?
If we're not...
If we're not, then you just killed someone real.
Existence is a low-tech, high-brow version of The Matrix, one that replaces flying kung fu kicks with amusing ideas, starting with the slightly radical notion that the world's leading game programmer would be a woman. This is Cronenberg's first original script since 1982, and you can feel his playful intelligence at work in the details. The weapons made from bone and teeth to escape metal detectors. The conceit that game programmers will soon become pop culture superstars like Tarantino or Madonna. And the notion of a new fundamentalism that insists on the primacy of real reality over mere imagination. Cronenberg has always been fascinated by the body and its relationship to consciousness, be it James Woods' character inserting tapes into his stomach in Videodrome, or the characters in Crash seeking sexual excitement in the metallic violence of automobile accidents. In Existence, people literally plug themselves into game pods in order to find richer and more expressive lives than the ones they're actually living. Ironically, it's this game world that's the least interesting part of Existence. Each time Allegra and Ted plug in, the action starts to lose its urgency. This is partly because Cronenberg doesn't deal in Matrix-like action scenes, but mainly because each new level of reality undercuts the others rather than enriching them. We don't care what happens to Allegra and Ted. They're just fictional characters dealing with realities that even they know are fictional. There's nothing important at stake. In the end, Existence the movie is merely a game.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Chris Fraley, Fred Snyder, Al Banks, Joyce Lieberman, and Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant, research assistants from Sam Adams. For Terry Gross, I'm Ken Tucker.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publisher of 1863, The Rebirth of a Nation by Joseph E. Stevens, about the year that helped shape America's destiny, and Little Brown and Company, publisher of White Oleander, a novel by Janet Fitch, now available in hardcover at bookstores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.